All right, so let's start up with this next one. So we're going to talk even more in depth just about contracts. You know, last lecture and a half or so was about how the law works, but now let's talk about a contract specifically, okay? And I like to start. What is a contract? What are we looking at specifically? Oh, actually, let me do it like a slide as opposed to the slideshow because I need it for my video. Contract is an agreement between two or more parties that is enforceable under law. The enforceability is also important. We're going to talk a little bit about it between a void and a valid contract and unenforceable and what that means. But it is an agreement between two or more parties that's enforceable law. What is the reason why we have contracts? Well, remember, contracts was number 6 on our list. And the law, what do we want about the law? It's for predictability and safety of parties, and that's exactly what we have here. It's to tie down the future, it's predictability. If I prepare you a good set of drawings, I've added in good now to mine instead of just a set of drawings, you must pay me $10,000. The prediction is, if I do my job, you will do yours. That's what the future will hold. We are writing down in our contract, we are predicting the future. It's kind of interesting to think about that a contract is like a crystal ball. It's like a time capsule of what should be expected. Because when that product isn't delivered at the end and something goes wrong, you say, look at these promises that were made. We tried to predict the future. They failed to produce under the promise. The most important thing that comes down to a contract is there must be a meeting of the minds. When you said you were going to give me a good set of drawings, did we understand? Did we both have a meeting of the minds of what that is? Did we have the proper language as to what the standard of care is between the architect and the owner? Was there enough information provided? I didn't understand that that's what you wanted. It didn't say two bedroom, two bath. It said design me a house, so I designed you a one house, one room ranch. Was there a meeting of the minds? Did we get there? And meeting of the minds, and that's a really simple situation because you would imagine if an owner came and said, I want you to design me a house, they would say, you would say, what kind of house? Hopefully you would say, ranch, colonial, whatever, two bedrooms, two baths. Hopefully you would have those discussions. So that's really basic and simple. But there are many layers to contracts. When I draft a 350-page contract for a candy factory, hopefully that's got everything in it, but there may be some differences, and we actually had that on our project as to certain meetings of the minds. What had to do with how a loading dock was sloped. It wasn't in the drawings. We thought it was supposed to be sloped this way. True story. When you bring in and you build candy, obviously you create candy, you have a lot of glucose, sugar. And there's a certain type of truck that dumps the sugar. Well, the ramp where they back the truck up has a slope, so the water flows down. You don't want the water flowing into your building, so you slope the land so the water flows away from the building. Well, the slope was so much, and it wasn't a lot, but it was enough, that when the tractor went up with his, and there's only certain tractors to carry the glucose, but when the tractor went up and it dumped, it couldn't get to a full height, and so anywhere between 4 and 6% of that glucose didn't dump into the hopper. Well, 4 and 6% of glucose, when you produce 100 million tons of candy every single month, is a lot of glucose, and it's a lot of money. And so that was a dispute. And there was a question whether there was a meeting of the minds as to whether the slope should have been there or not. They were designing for slope of water. Did you tell us the slope should have been there? They ended up making calls back to Germany because there was other issues because they were thinking about a different truck that they use in Germany and there was not a meeting of the minds and so we didn't have a claim against them and we worked it out. They are a really good contractor, so they helped us in trying to solve that. They want the next factory, but those are the issues that come up. There was there a meeting of the minds? So, I like to run this clip. You guys just got a black screen. You probably didn't know what it was. Does anybody know who Groucho Marx is? We got one. Thank God. Oh, you got a couple. Groucho Marx was a comedian back in the 50s and 60s, maybe even earlier than that. You'll see his face. You'll probably recognize he had this big, these round glasses and this big bushy mustache, and he used to make jokes and everything else. And he had a brother. There was the three of them. There was the Marx brothers. There was Groucho, Harpo, and Zeppo. This is he and Harpo talking about what a contract is.
I pay particular attention to this place first because it's most important.
Groucho's on the right.
The body of the faithful, you know, the contract is the body of the faithful.
Contracts. And that's what I'm going to try not to have you guys have to deal with over the next 10 weeks or so, 12 weeks, or however long we're here in this class, to learn how to not be in contracts like that. And I put that on there because contracts are they're drafted that way, still to this day. And what I like to do and what I try to do with this class is to help you understand. And even the AIA contracts are going to have language that you'll be like, what the heck does this mean? And my job is to help you guys understand that. And I put that up every year. I, you know, obviously being a little bit older, I never saw Groucho or Zeppo or Harpo. They were still alive when I was younger, your age, but I never saw them perform. They were one of the most famous comedic trio that was, you know, like Laurel and Hardy and some of the other ones, the Marx Brothers, if you ever look up the Marx Brothers. And so I like to put that up. As the class gets longer and longer into it, people don't even know who they are, but it's still a representative of what contracts can be like. So let's talk about what types of contracts there can be. So we know the written contracts. We've heard about that. I've mentioned oral, but there's what's called express contracts, and express contracts can be written in oral. An express contract is simple as what it sounds like. You have expressly communicated to each other what the promises are. Okay? Implied contracts are implied in fact contracts. They are not necessarily oral or written. They are what everybody expects. So when you go to a doctor, or if you have a pet and you go to a vet, there is an implied contract between the two of you that the doctor will render good services. The doctor will perform in a standard of care. How many of you, I know you guys, when you go to a doctor, you have to fill out the forms for insurance and you circle the little outline of the figure to show where the aches and pains are. But how many of you have ever signed a contract with your doctor that says, I'm going to provide you these services and you're going to pay me? You never do that. Because it's an implied in fact contract that they are going to examine you and use their best standard of care as a doctor to tell you what's wrong. That's an implied in fact. The actions that are being taken is expected by the parties that there will be a contract between each other. Because if the doctor doesn't tell you you have cancer, and you have cancer and it missed you, and you could have figured it out and maybe had radiation and treatments beforehand, you can sue that doctor as a tort, because they have failed to provide you with the services, but you can also sue a breach of contract. So we have this implied in fact contract, and you failed to do your job. And you can get causation. We showed up, we had this implied in fact contract, you didn't perform, you had a duty to, there was a breach, there was causation, there was damages, injuries. Okay? Quasi-contracts. Those are implied in law as opposed to fact. So, there could be an agreement between two or more parties that they had no obligation before to each other, but the law creates an obligation to you. It's imposed even if neither party originally intended there to be a contract. We didn't enter into a contract, we didn't intend, but the law will impose it upon them, implied in law. Another one is if somebody was unjustly enriched. Hey, I did this for you. You got benefit from me. I know we never signed a contract, but you got benefit from me. You were unjustly enriched. You need to pay me for that. Even though we never had a contract, the law will create one. A quasi-contract, the law will create that contract. Okay? What's an example of that? So you have somebody come over. This actually happened to me, although we didn't have to worry about a contract issue. I had a contractor come over because we had a leak in a roof. And he was up there working on the area where the leak was, and he came to me and he said, you know, while we were there, there was some other stuff that we saw in another area that was not leaking, that we didn't have a problem. We went ahead and fixed it anyway. So I didn't ask them to do that. I didn't have a contract for them to do it. We had, because I had different pitches in different areas, and it was fully in different areas of the house. But they were there with their team, and they went ahead and did the work. Now, if he had came down before they actually did the work and asked me and said, hey, I saw this other area, it looks like it needs patching, can we do that? Do you want us to do that? That would have created an oral contract and would have said yes. But what ended up happening was he came down and he said, while we were up there, we did some more patching. And it's an implied in law quasi-contract because they fixed it and I had them up there working, and the law will say you should have to pay him for that. Which I did anyway. I wasn't going to challenge him. Like, thank God you fixed it. I went another week later. I didn't know it was there. But that would be an implied in law, because even though he was hired to fix a roof leak and he saw another one, and so that's what the law will create, a change to that contract, an increase to make sure that he isn't damage because he put in time and money, time and effort, and that I was unjustly enriched. So that's the difference. The law will create this contract as opposed to implied in fact. The law doesn't have to create the contract when you go visit your doctor. Make sense? Okay. Bilateral contracts versus unilateral contracts. So a bilateral contract is when you have exchange of mutual parties and both parties are doing something. I will design, you will pay. Both parties have an obligation to each other, or if it's multiple parties, there would be multiple parties have obligations to each other. But it's not just one-sided. A bilateral contract means both sides need to do something. A unilateral contract, it's like a contest with no promise of performance. So neither one party doesn't have to do something in order to recover. Every year, and I don't know when it comes out, but it'll be coming out soon, McDonald's has their Monopoly contest, where you go to McDonald's and you peel off on the French fry or on your drink, you peel a little thing off, and it's got whether you win another free fries or $1 million. Or the Coca-Cola bottle cap, when you turn the cap up and you turn up in the cap and it says you win $1 million. That is a unilateral contract, because if you ever hear those ads running on TV and the guy talks really super fast, it says, no participation necessary, void or prohibited. They must say that because all these contests, the McDonald's contest, the Monopoly contest for McDonald's, or the cap contest for these folks and everything else, you actually don't have to buy the French fries to participate, because it's a unilateral agreement. In fact, you could write to McDonald's and say, I want to enter your Monopoly contest, because it's going to be in a tiny little print that says it's no participation necessary. I don't want to buy French fries, but I want to have one token for your Monopoly contest. And you're supposed to get one, because it's a unilateral contract. They can't say, you must buy our food in order to participate in our contest, because the laws of the states won't allow that. So that's a unilateral contract. No obligation by one party in order to benefit from the other. And if for some reason you write that letter to McDonald's and say, can I have one token to enter into your $1 million prize? And if they send you that one token in the mail, all you have to do is write them, and it says you win $1 million, they have to pay you. They can't say, you didn't buy my French fries. You didn't have to participate. You just had to ask to get the token. So, and they may have restrictions. You can maybe only get once. You know, you may was willing to win. But if you keep buying a bunch of fries, you get as many as you want, but you can only get one. They may have those restrictions. But that's what a unilateral contract is. Is a contract valid? So maybe you have this express contract. It's between two parties. It's bilateral. So we have this agreement. I'll design something for you. You need to pay. Now we have to see, is that contract valid? So there's four things you want to think about. Is it valid? If it's valid, then we can enforce it and we're good. And most contracts are valid. Or is it void? Or is it voidable? Or is it unenforceable? Now the three down below ultimately may or may not be something that you can then prevail on a contract. You may have this agreement between the two parties. I'll do this for you and you do that for me. And so therefore, we should have a deal. But one of these three things could come up, and there's no deal. The courts, the law will say your contract was never valid. Alright, so what does that mean? A void contract is not legally valid or enforceable at any point. It doesn't matter if everybody had good intentions. It doesn't matter if it's written down and covers every single thing. The law says you can never have that contract. The easiest one to think about is a minor. You cannot enter into a contract with a minor. Even though you hire Johnny on the street to cut your lawn for $20 a week, if Johnny wanted to enforce that contract, it's actually a void contract because he's a minor and they can't enforce it. Let's hope you pay Johnny his $20 a week to cut the lawn, but it's a void contract. It doesn't exist. Another type of void contract, because it's illegal, is a crime. I can't hire you to commit a crime and pay you. Like, if you go out and kill somebody for me as an assassin and I don't pay you, not like you're going to bring it to court anyway, but you can't enforce it because it's a crime. Okay? You know? It's simple because you're never going to try to enforce it, but the law would never enforce that. And that's where it comes in, is whether it's against public policy or against a regulation. It may be not a crime, but the regulation, they say these parties may not do that. They may be not asking you something illegal like a crime, and they don't know this, and they enter into contract to do something, and the regulation says no. Like an example maybe in the architecture world is, I want you to design me a house for this lot, and the lot is zoned as commercial as opposed to residential. Could that contract be enforced? Probably not, because the regulation says you never could have built a residential building on that property. So that would be, the contract is void. Voidable contract is, you think it's valid and legal, but something occurs that shows it's illegal or voidable. It's not illegal, but voidable. It could be performed, but something voided may cancel. If you withheld information, fraud, I didn't tell you all the facts, or I lied to you about it, so it seems valid, it's not a contract with a minor, I didn't ask you to kill someone, I asked you to do this, but you withheld information, you defrauded someone, or maybe even isn't intentional, but the information that needed to have been brought forward wasn't there, and so the courts can void that contract. So it's valid on its face, it's not illegal as a void contract, but it becomes voidable. Misrepresentation, undue influence. I'm going to hurt you if you sign this contract. It's valid, you're going to cut the lawn, you're an 18-year-old person, I'll pay you $20, but if you force them to do that, the court will say it's voidable. Or, as I get down all the way over here, this mutual mistake, there wasn't that meeting of the minds because there was a party in the first part, and the party in the second part, and the third part, and then so forth and so on. You didn't know what it meant. So something happens to make it voidable. Could be even the mistake could be you didn't know that Johnny was 17, you thought he was 18, and so that contract you thought was valid, and the court will come back and void it because it's a voidable agreement. Last one, unenforceable contract, it cannot be enforced in a court of law, and that could be various reasons. It could be because of duress and fraud and unconscionability and safety, all those things would fall into the voidable category. But it also can call down to this, what's called statute of limitations and laches, which we don't have to worry about laches. The statute of limitations is, means we had a valid contract way up here. It was a bilateral contract. It was expressed. It was in writing. And we said, I'll design you a building. You'll pay me $10,000. And that transaction happened, but it was, I'll design you a good building. And then the wall falls down, and you don't sue me for 5 years. The contract says it's unenforceable because you needed to sue me within 4 years of that wall falling down. So it was valid. We even exchanged our promises, but one of the promises was good drawings. And since you sued me too late, it doesn't matter if your drawings were good or bad, I was too late in suing you. And so the statute of limitations made it unenforceable. So an unenforceable contract is something that could have been valid, or could have been void, or voidable, but the courts will never enforce it because of these other items. And that's where I want you to understand, and as we went down, it comes more and more, like, the concept of mistake is in an unenforceable, and it's in voidable, it's in avoidable. So, it could be voidable, and that's why it's unenforceable. So if you find something that's valid, but it's voidable, it will be then, by law, unenforceable. Does that make sense? Okay. Elements of valid contract. So we have the elements of a claim. These are pretty similar, but there's a little bit difference of how they're termed. You have to have an offer. I will give you this if you give me that. I will design, give you a set of good designs if you pay me $10,000. That's the offer. Every contract must have an offer. There must be acceptance. The acceptance is proper, meaning, yes, I agree, you give me good drawings, and I will pay you $10,000. The acceptance must mirror the offer. If it's different, it's not an acceptance. The proper acceptance is the meeting of the minds. The offer and the acceptance must mirror to show the parties had a meeting of the minds. Mutual consideration. We'll get into a little more depth about there must both parties must have consideration. Think of consideration as something you must give or give up. The owner will have consideration of giving $10,000. The architect's consideration is I'm giving my time to you to create the drawings. Both parties are offering or giving up something, having mutual consideration. And then fine, there's absence of valid defense. It's not void, it's not voidable, it's not enforceable. It's a legal valid contract. If you have these four elements, we're good. We got a contract and we go forward. Alright? Now, let's talk about the offer and acceptance, that first element. The recipient may reject the offer or make a counteroffer. No, it's $10,000, I'm not going to do it. There's no contract. We're all at square one. Or, yeah, give me those good drawings, but I'm going to do it with you for $8,000, not $10,000. That offer is gone. It doesn't exist. It terminates the offer. And so what's happened is now you have a counteroffer. I'll give you $8,000 for those architectural services. The architect now must have proper acceptance to create a contract. And there can be miscommunications as to, wow, did they accept or not? Was it a mirror or not? Think about that, because that may be elements that you're going to look at in the exam. Is there a mirror of the offer and acceptance? If you don't have that, no contract was ever created. An offer will terminate after a reasonable period of time. I'll give you a good building, you pay me $10,000. If you respond to me in the first week, or maybe the first month, yes, seems reasonable, and yes, I agree to your terms. If you call me up in a year and say, yeah, I agree to your terms, you as the architect could say, no, my rates have gone up, it's 15 grand. You did not properly accept my offer in a reasonable period of time. Reasonable in quotes here is because what is reasonable? For that offer and acceptance of that contract, is it a month, is it 2 months, is it 6 months, is it a year? You have to kind of look at the fact and scenario. What does the industry look at? What does the court common law say is reasonable? What would the normal public think is reasonable? So there's kind of to your standard of care question. Sometimes you're going to see a contract that says, this offer, this proposal is valid for 30 days only. And that what's happened is in that proposal, when you say, I'll do your design for $10,000, you are creating the reasonableness to it. So you can do that in your agreements, and I would recommend doing that when you submit a proposal. But if not, somebody else, judge or jury, is going to have to decide whether a month, 3 months, 6 months, a year is reasonable or not. But it could terminate. And then the other offer terminates as a matter of death or insanity of the parties or destruction of the subject matter. If I make an offer to someone with respect to services or work that needs to be done at my house, and then I get hit by a bus, and that person comes to my door and asks my wife for I cut the lawn or whatever the services that I was going to do, that contract is terminated because I'm the party that made the offer, so I'm no longer there for them to enforce it against me. Or if I'm crazy and I make some stupid thing, then they can't enforce it against them. Or destruction of subject matter. The thing here is like, I will sell you my car for $10,000 and you agree, yes, I will pay you $10,000 for your car. And then as I'm on my way over to you, I get in a car accident and I bang up the car. I can't force you to pay me $10,000 for that car because it wasn't the car that I made an offer about. It was a car that wasn't damaged. Now I have a new car, a different car. I, by my own poor driving, have created damage. Could be fire, could be theft, something like the building burned down or whatever. And I can't force you to pay me $10,000 because we have the contract, because it's not the same car. Or if there's a piece of property that a fire occurs on. It's common sense. And that's what the law is about, in contracts and everything else. We try to be common sense. But that's how an offer can be terminated, because the deal that we had, a meeting of the mind, somehow changed between the deal, the meeting of the mind, and the consummation of that deal. Okay? Now, what happens if I say I'm going to sell you that car for $10,000, and then it turns out that my wife reminds me that my son's getting his license in May? Oh my God, thank God this class will be over. You guys won't have to hear about it. But on May 20th, my son gets to start to drive. And so I don't want to sell that car. I want to keep the beater. She says, you can't sell that car. I need to revoke that offer. You know, I was going to sell that car to my neighbor, but I need to revoke that offer. What happens? Can I do that? And can I be stuck because they already accepted my promises? So you get into concepts of timing. The party can revoke the offer, and the revocation is effective upon communication to the other party. They must have knowledge of the revocation before the acceptance. Now, we live in a different age than when a lot of these laws were written. Before, people would do things in writing, and it'd go through the mail, and there's a mailbox rule we'll talk about in a second. Everything's instantaneous. It's email, it's text, it's what have you. So the timing issues don't come up nearly as often in the world these days with contracts, but they still do. And so you need to remember that an offer is out there and standing, and until it's accepted, it can be revoked. But the revocation must be communicated to the party before the acceptance. Now, what happens when the problems, what do you have between acceptance and revocation? Offers and the revocation are effective when received. Acceptance is effective when made. I send to you my offer to sell you my car for $10,000. I tell you on the street, I'll sell you my car for $10,000. My neighbor goes back and says, I got to talk to my husband if I want to sell it. Let me figure it out. Or I got to talk to my wife, whatever it might be, to make sure we want to buy that car. And they get back to their house and they send me an email and they say, I accept it. But before I get the email, I talk and I want to revoke it. And so I put a note in their door. I don't communicate to them. By the time I get back to my house, I see an email that says, we accept your offer. Is my revocation timely? Did I revoke it and communicate it, and did they have it before they accepted? Offer and revocation are when they received it. Did they actually get it? They have to understand it. But if they accepted it before, even if I revoked it, I can't, because they've already accepted. Okay? So there can be timing. It's not as common, like I said, because of email and text and everything else, but there can be timing of offers and revocations through the old world of mailbox and everything else, where you thought you had revoked it, and they come back to you and say, I already accepted it, and you have to sell me your car, and I don't care about the fact that Liam's getting his driver's license in 4 months. I need your car, and I have to sell it to him. So, the mailbox rule is what I was talking about, is this risk of crossing lines. What happens, though, if you reject your acceptance? That's a revocation of an acceptance. What do you do? And timing is important. And so, the acceptance effective when made, even if notice of acceptance is not yet received. What happens if you send an acceptance and then you revoke it before the other side gets... So, you send the acceptance on Tuesday and it's going through the regular mail and it gets to my house on Thursday. So I get a phone call from you on Wednesday to say I'm revoking my offer. What's the question? What do you think the answer is there? Is that revocation of the acceptance? Right. Which one? What do you think? You send the acceptance on Tuesday. Acceptance effective when made. So on Tuesday you accepted my offer. We're in the same thing. We have a mirror. I don't receive the acceptance until Thursday. But you call me on Wednesday and say I'm revoking my acceptance. Do we have a contract? What do you think? Who's got an answer? You say you do? Anybody say we don't? You say we don't. Why do you say we don't? Anybody else? Why do you say we have a valid contract? Or are you changing?
No, I'm going to hold it.
Okay. Okay. So the answer is it's been revoked because, interestingly enough, the acceptance is accepted when made if you want to keep it. Okay? If you want to enforce your acceptance, you can say, I accept it on Tuesday when I made it. Just because you got it on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and you decided to revoke it, you decided to change the deal, doesn't matter, I accepted it before you decided. In my scenario was, you accepted, and before I received the acceptance, which would be like the mutual meeting, you revoked it. And you called me and revoked it before I received the acceptance. The argument would be made is that even though I accepted it when I made it, I revoked it before you received it because the mere of the offer you hadn't received. So you are trying to, in this instance, and this is why this is a little more confusing, is because you are the party both accepting and now trying to rescind or revoke your own acceptance. This general rule here of acceptance is effectively made is when you want to enforce your own acceptance and you never pulled it back. And when someone on the other side tries to pull it back, that's why the revocation is the receive. Does that make sense? Okay. Consideration. We talked a little about it for a second when I said, what is consideration? It is the giving or agreeing to give something of value. It's the performing or offering to perform something of detriment. So you can perform something, or you offer to perform something, and while it's detriment, I mean, it's your business. Like, I perform legal services, and so while I don't think of it necessarily as to my detriment, it does take away from my life and my family and my friends and everything else. So conceptually, offering service to someone is actually to your detriment, because if you had to do it for free, why would you do it? So the agreeing of giving to somebody of value is like I give you money, or I give you my car, or I give you something else. Offering to perform something could be a detriment. Or it could be even so much so that, you know what, I'm going to give away something. I'm going to not perform something. There could be actually that would be detrimental. Normally I like to have, maybe you're selling a piece of your property, so you're giving away your property that's detrimental to your happiness or whatever. So, but it's, the consideration is that you're giving or offering to give something, the other party is giving or offering to give something. It's something of value on both sides. What type of consideration? Simple, payment of money, that's an easy consideration. Performing a service, that's what we're talking about. Giving up ownership of something. I'm giving you my car. I'm giving up ownership of that. Or agreeing to forego something that has the possibility of being valuable in the future. I'm going to sell my business to you. I can keep that business and keep making money. There's a restaurant in our neighborhood that I live in, Wilmette, and it's like it's called Keeping the Wagle. It's just a Mexican restaurant. It's no big deal. They have great margaritas and everything else. Family owned, been there for 20-some years. And there's this upscale burger place called Al Chaval. There's this one downtown. There's a couple other ones that are really fancy, schmancy. And they opened up with some chains, and they call them the Small Chaval instead of Al Chaval. And so Al Chaval, they're baking a ton of dough, this company, and they came in and they went to the owners of Deep in the Huevo, and they said, we want your space and your location, and they never thought they'd ever sell. They love being in this restaurant business and everything. And then Al Chaval made an offer they couldn't refuse, so they gave up something of detriment, something of value. They could have kept the business, and there was an article like, they said, we would have done this for the rest of our lives. There's a couple that was in their 50s or 60s, and they said, we would have done this forever. We love being restaurateurs and everything else. But they gave us something, like, they gave us an offer we couldn't refuse. They were paid money. That was what Al Chaval gave them. That was this consideration Al Chaval. And the people that ran Deep in the Wave forgave something that had value to them. They had a contract. That was the consideration. Pretty simple. Any questions on that? What else about consideration is the problem? Illusory promises do not constitute consideration. A promise that isn't really a promise. this one side is only one side required to perform. Now, not on the unilateral contract. This is a bilateral contract. It could be unenforceable. Maybe there's deception. Maybe there's unclear language. It's a promise, but not really a promise. Example, I will sell you everything I want to. I know it sounds kind of crazy, pretty simple, but there's no promise in there. It's only if I decide to sell you it. Like, I promise, come look at my house. You can look at anything you want, and I'm going to sell you anything in there if I want to sell it to you. That's not a promise. Or, I may sell this to you for a price that I decide. That's an illusory promise. You can't walk on a car lot and it says, make me an offer. And then you have to enforce it. I made him an offer. It said, make me an offer. And I told him I'd buy that car for $5,000. And he said, no. Don't we have a contract? No. Because it didn't have a price. And he said, I'll sell it to you for whatever I want to sell it. Now, these two examples are, like, I try to make these examples at like 60,000 feet. So it's really basic and simple because I don't want to get into the depths of the law and illusory promises. But that's what it is. It's really, it's a not a promise. I promise, but I'm not really making any promise. That's an illusory no consideration. Okay? Consideration may go to a third party. I enter into a contract with you. I had a case about this. I represented a builder, and there was a contract entered into with the owner to buy a little strip mall, or to build a strip mall for his daughter. He was building generational wealth. She was the intended beneficiary of the strip mall. There were some problems with the strip mall. There were some leaks and other ones. Not my client's fault. And his daughter sued us. We didn't have a contract with her. We were like, there was no consideration between us. But there was. There was the transfer of the consideration because she was the beneficiary of that contract. The owner, the dad, paid the money to us, so he provided consideration. Her name was represented in the contract, and we knew we were building it for the daughter. We provided services that it was our consideration, and so when it came down later in the lawsuit, she was a party saying, I didn't get the benefit of the deal. And we couldn't make the argument there was no consideration with her because it had been transferred by the dad to her, that consideration. Substitution of consideration, detrimental reliance, meaning, hey, I relied on you. You told me that you would pay me if I did X, Y, and Z. I relied on you to my detriment. I did this to my detriment. I stopped doing this to my detriment. Something like that. Out of reliance. You promised to give me that. That was the mutual consideration. You never did. So there can be mutual consideration if it's detrimentally relied upon. To the negative of yourself is the detrimental reliance. I'm not going to ask you a question on whether detrimental reliance happened in a contract, but I just want you to know that it exists. I may ask you, Sally and Bobby got into this agreement and this happened. Was there consideration? That may be the type of question that I'm going to ask. Okay? Defenses to a valid contract. Remember, it's offer, acceptance, consideration, and are there defenses to this valid contract? That was the fourth element from that very first slide. Mutual mistake of fact. Both parties thought they were going to be designing the house on this property, and it turned out that the property was zoned for commercial. Neither party understood that you couldn't put a house on it. That contract, while seemingly valid, has a defense to enforce because neither party could have enforced it. I thought Sally was 18. She was 17 when I asked her to cut my lawn. I guess that would be only a unilateral mistake because Sally would hope know that she's only 17. So that's probably not a good example. But a mutual mistake of fact, the court will not enforce. If the both parties mixed up and they didn't come. They came to a meeting of the minds, but it was the wrong meeting of minds. Unilateral mistake, not always a defense. A lot of times the courts are going to be like, well, one party knew it, the other party didn't, maybe you didn't do your due diligence. So it's not always a defense, sometimes they will. But what the court will try to do is called reformation. They will try to take the contract and do their best to fix it, to reform it. If they can't, they rescind it. That means they yank the contract and it doesn't exist. They say like the contract never existed. I had a case where a client of mine bought a house in a brand new subdivision. It was on like a sloping hill, and it went down, and they were at the bottom of the cul-de-sac, at the very bottom of the subdivision, and then way off in the field was a big retention pond that the water, as it flowed down, would go into the sewer system and dump into the retention pond, and so that nobody's house would flood. Okay? That was the agreement. Turned out my client's house flooded all the time. Basically, get tons of water. The contractor didn't build it right. There was all this fight about whether they did the civil engineering proper. All this, it was like tons and tons of stuff. Lots of dollars. The litigation would have been extraordinary. It would have been much more expensive to litigate it, to fix the house, to get out of the house and everything else. And so what we did is we moved to the court for rescission. We said there was a unilateral mistake. We didn't understand X, Y, and Z, and it was one-sided. But they never informed us of this, this, and this. Part of it was the retention pond wasn't big enough. We didn't know that. Part of it was the way the civil engineering was done. We didn't know that. So we asked the court to rescind the contract. And that's exactly what they did. The court said, my client paid like $565,000 for the house. The court said, give the $565,000 back to this client, and we moved out. And we didn't have to have a house that leaked, we didn't have to have a house that flooded, we didn't have to try to sell it, we didn't have to litigate it. The court just said, this contract never existed, we've rescinded it based on this unilateral mistake. And my client bought a house in another subdivision and got the money back. So, fraud, you lied to me. That's a valid defense. You can't enforce this contract, you lied to me. You committed fraud. It was illegal. I'm a minor. You asked me to kill someone, whatever it might be. This contract is not enforceable because it's illegal. Lack of capacity. I'm actually crazy. You can't enforce a contract with somebody that's crazy. Lack of capacity. Duress or coercion. You had a gun to my head. You were forcing me to sign this. The courts will not enforce a contract that is signed or executed under coercion or duress. Questions on that? These are more relevant. Like, you know, I'll tell you this. Let me go back to this slide really quick. Of this sign, I've had arguments of mutual mistake effect, never been able to prevail on it because it's always like, no. I had the one unilateral for the rescission. I've had some fraud claims, never prevailed, because most of the time if you're being accused of fraud, you want to settle. You don't need a court judgment against that you defrauded somebody. So these have all settled. So I haven't had a case I've won on that. I've never had an illegal contract. I've never had a coercion contract. I've never had a duress. So there's only a couple in here that I've really taken all the way to the mat, because it doesn't come up very much in contract. These come up in other things. But it's not as big a deal. It's not as repetitive. And it certainly won't happen very much in your profession. This one will. This one's important. This one comes up all the time. In the case I have right now, in front of the arbitrators, there's a bunch of subcontractors, a bunch of people that did, like, you know, plumbing and electrical and stuff like that. They are all trying to get on what's this called statute of limitations. What is a statute of limitations? It means it's a statute in writing, and you are limited as a claimant, as someone bringing the complaint, the plaintiff. You are limited in a period of time. That's the limitation. You must file your suit within this period of time. If you're outside of that limited period, you can't ever bring your claim even if you had 100% winner. For a written contract in the state of Illinois, you must file that suit in 10 years. For an oral contract in the state of Illinois, you must file that lawsuit in 5 years. But for construction, we got something new or something unique for construction. So for all you guys' purposes, you can forget about 10 and 5 because it'll never have anything to do with you if it deals with your practice and profession. In Illinois, you must file that lawsuit within 4 years, not 5, not 10, but 4 years, from the discovery of the problem. When you knew or should have known something went wrong, that lawsuit needs to be filed. But here's a weird thing about it. You have 10 years to discover it. So it could be 10 years plus 4. It's potential. And I had one lawsuit where we filed the lawsuit in like the 10th month of the 13th year, and we were within the statute of limitations. Because my client didn't discover it for almost 10 years. It was a leak. And it didn't show, and it was in a gym, and it was way up on top, and there was a subceiling, and it didn't leak all the time, and it was years and years, and it was a very slow leak. And it took many years for the materials to deteriorate. And then eventually the drywall collapsed, and then we found out. And then the leak over that period of time got bigger and bigger on the outside because it was life and weather and freeze thaw and everything else. And so it became much more problematic. So they didn't discover it for like 9 years. And then they didn't hire me for a couple more years because they thought it was going to be a smaller deal, and they tried to fix it. And blah, blah. And I finally got a call. I'm like, oh my God, we got to file this. And we filed it in like month 10 of the 13th year. So you could go way, way out. But I'll give you an example where it works the opposite side. So in my case, right now, there's another problem with the leak, another leaky issue. We filed our lawsuit, our arbitration demand, in 2019. But the contractor, my client was in the building, and my client told the contractor about the leak in 2016. We didn't even file a lawsuit. My client didn't file a lawsuit until 2019. The subcontractor who installed the roof is saying to the contractor, you knew in 2016. So the statute of limitations for 4 years, because my client called up the contractor and said, this house is leaking in 2016. My client didn't file the suit until 2019. So we were within the 4 years of statute of limitations when we discovered it. It's only 3 years from when we discovered it. The subcontractor saying, you contractor should have also, you knew when the owner told you in 2016, you knew about the problem, you should have sued us within 4 years of that. The contractor saying, I had 4 years from when I got sued. So they got sued in 2019, they're saying they had till 2023. So is it from 2016 to 2020? Or is it from 2019 to 2023? That's an issue in this case right now for the subcontractor. When did this start? Because the discovery happened was well within the 10 years. Discovery occurred in 2016. The parties knew about it then. Does the clock start in 16 or 19? We don't know yet. The court has to make a decision on it. That's an issue with statute of limitations. And if the court says it started in 2016, the roofer is out of the case. But the contractor's not, because my client sued within 4 years of 2016. We hit the statute of limitations, but the contractor going after the roofer did not, maybe. We don't know yet. So, that's an issue that happens. And it happens in construction all the time. When did you find out about it? Was it within 10 years of the work being performed? And after you found out about it, did you sue them? And the language is knew or should have known. If I look up and I see drip, 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 roofs aren't supposed to leak. I don't have to know what the cause of the leak is. I don't have to know where the leak is. But I should have known because I saw drip, drip, drip. Question? Yes. Right. Do you have a claim against the contractor? Is that your question?
Or the, I don't know if you have a claim against the person who bought a farm or built it or yeah.
So the first answer is you do not have a claim against the contractor because the contractor is only on the hook for when he or she performed the work, and whatever he or she did that's defective needs to have been discovered in 10 years. So once that 10 years has come and gone, it doesn't matter who owned it or when owned it and everything else, the contractor is completely out and doesn't have a problem. Or if there's an issue and it's 4 years and somebody didn't say anything, the contractor doesn't have to worry about it, or the architect or anything else. So they are out of the picture. The next question is, because you didn't buy it from the contractor or the architect or whatever, you bought it from a previous owner, do you have a claim against that person? And the answer is, it depends. Depends on if they know, it depends if you can prove they know, and then it depends on what your real estate agreement is. Sometimes real estate agreements say as is. Sometimes real estate agreement says you have the opportunity to bring in an inspector, and if the inspector didn't see it, then is your claim isn't really against the inspector. So a lot of it depends, but my recommendation is if you bought a house and it leaks, the first thing I would do is go after the previous owner and make a claim against them and try to say, hey, you sold us a house that leaks and you probably knew. The real estate contracts are very different than construction contracts, and they are very protective of realtors first and protective of the sellers second. So it's not as easy a road to prevail on. I will tell you this, the exact same thing happened to my parents. Many, many years ago, After my dad was looking to retire, they bought a house in northern Michigan as kind of a small, tiny little lake house that had a skylight, and it leaked. And they didn't know it. And when my mom and dad went for the second and last inspection, they didn't even think about it, but there were some paint buckets in the kitchen, and it turned out that they had been, right before the inspection, they had painted the ceiling because the ceiling showed water stains on it. And so when they moved in, and my parents moved in, you know, they bought it in the summer, and by the time they got to the winter and there was snow sitting on the skylight, it was drip, drip, drip in the kitchen, they were like, this is crazy, and my dad remembered seeing the paint buckets, and we sued the previous owner. He happened to be a realtor, too, and it was actually his son, and we sued the realtor's son because apparently he was the one who was involved in painting it out and everything else. It wasn't very expensive to fix. I think we got like $6,000 or $7,000, and we fixed the skylight, and everything was fine. But our position was, you hid it from us. And we had some good evidence. The buckets of paint were right there. I mean, they were like, paint it the day before and clean up, but they didn't do that. But that was a claim that we could legitimately make against them because we showed it in favor of that was a problem. So, any other questions from that? Yes?
I'm not understanding from date of act and that was when the project was finished.
That's a great question. Date of act or omission, the 10 years. So the way the courts look at it with respect to construction is, if the roof was built effectively that ultimately resulted in the leak, so you didn't put proper flashing, or if it was like a membrane roof, when you were walking around on it and you were walking on it, punctured it so it had a hole in it. The courts are generally going to look at the date of act or omission of when the actual work was performed, the installation of the work. And so the discovery period is from the work being performed. Some contracts will say, like, you're building a big building, maybe it takes a year to complete the building. And maybe the roof, or maybe one of the problems, maybe some of the structure is not structurally sound, so that was put in like on month two or three, and all the finishing work happened way down later. Sometimes the courts will say it's when the building was entirely complete that we start the clock. So the contract may say it's not when the work was actually performed, because you may not be able to figure out the roof was performed on May 2nd, but when we turned over the building to the owner was July 31st, the contract may say all clocks start on July 31st because the project took a year. So there's sometimes that. But generally, it's when the work is performed, the act or omission. Okay? Yes, question?
Can you explain the 10-year, 4-year, like, layering?
Sure. Yeah, great question. Okay. So I move into a building, and I see a leak 6 years into the project. They're 6 years into being into the building. I have discovered it. This 10 years is the discovery period. Within the 10 years, so I discovered it in year 6. I can then bring a lawsuit for 4 years after year 6, so I can bring it up to year 10. 6 probably wasn't the best because now we're at year 10, so just so that's me. Let's say I discovered it in year 7, okay? If I file a lawsuit before the end of year 11, then I'm within the both statute of repose, that's what this is called, the discovery period, and the statute of limitations. So I can have a discovery of a default on day 364 of the ninth year and still get 4 more years to file my lawsuit. But if I discover this on day 2, that the leak is the second day I moved in, I got 4 years to file that lawsuit after I discover it. I don't get 10 years. I get 4 years in 2 days, or 1 day, because I got to do it before 4 years. So once you discover it, you have 10 years to discover. Once you discover it, you only got 4 years. And this discovery can happen anywhere on that 10-year timeline. But as soon as you know it, well, actually, it's knew or should have known. That's what the language says. As soon as you knew or should have known, you only got 4 years to go. Okay?
Should have known
is I saw a leak in the roof, but I didn't see that it was the hole in the membrane or the way they did the flashing or the gutters weren't put in. I don't know exactly what caused, but I sure should have known because roofs don't leak. So I should have known. And so then my obligation, what the courts are saying, is once you see something that doesn't look right, you have an obligation to figure it out in 4 years to sue them. You can't just sit back down and say, yeah, we kept putting buckets under it, kept putting buttons under it. It didn't bother us, so it was no big deal. And then in year 5, you're like, God, man, it was something, maybe it's really bad. And you open up and you're like, oh my God, it's falling apart and it's rusting and it's deteriorated. I'm going to sue that contractor. Well, the courts are like, no, you should have known back when you first saw that first drip, and you should have done something. That's what that should have known means. Did you have another question? Okay. Assignment. What do you do with contracts? Can you assign like this? I enter into contract with you. Can I give that contract to somebody else? Can I give it to my next door neighbor? Can I give it to my daughter, like in the case of that one they didn't sign? Yes, you can assign a contract. You and I enter into a contract with each other. And where this comes in mostly is business. Think about it this way. I'm Mike Hanahan, architecture. I'm a sole proprietor. I'm just kind of chugging along, doing houses, living my life, doing a great job, and I have contracts with people to build and to design houses. You guys are paying me and everything else. Somebody comes and says, hey, Mike, would you like to be my partner? Or maybe we're going to buy your business. It's no longer Mike Hanahan Architecture. It's MJH Architecture. It becomes a bigger company. You don't have a contract with MJH Architecture. You have a contract with Mike Hanahan Architecture. I'm going to assign my contract to the new business entity. And MJH Architecture now gets the benefit of that assignment and that contract, so you have to pay now MJH Architecture. And all the rights, but all the obligations that I had as the individual are now owned by the company. So everything transfers over. That's an assignment. Giving a contractual right or duty to another party and being disconnected. So me now as an individual are no longer responsible or liable. The company that now has protected by corporate protections and all this other stuff, so they can't take my house and my car and everything else if something goes wrong. They will sue the company. They assume all the obligations and get all the benefits. So you can do an assignment of a contract. And most times the clauses in the contract will say, assignment of contract's allowed so long as the other party agrees. You know, you're not going to do this unilateral assignment, but sometimes it happens. But that's where it happens. Like I said, lots of times in business, when one business is bought by the other, the new company gets assigned the contract. Delegation is the same as the contract, as assignment, except the giver still stays involved in the transaction. So if, instead of Mike Hanahan Architecture created this new MJH Architecture, maybe it was Mike Hanahan Architecture and I'm retiring or I don't want to work anymore, and so I have Sally Jones Architectural Services is another architecture company down the street. I'm going to delegate the responsibility to Sally Jones Company. I have no relationship with them other than she's going to take over my stuff. If I delegate those duties to her and I don't assign the contract to her, if something goes wrong and Sally does something wrong, you can sue both me and Sally because I only delegated it. Even though I gave the responsibilities to her, and she's assuming responsibilities, I'm still in the mix. So the recommendation of that is don't delegate your contracts, because you're not in control. But it happens, just so you know. Okay, what can be assigned or delegated? Personal duties usually cannot be assigned or delegated. Now, personal duties is different than services. Like architectural services aren't necessarily a personal duty. But if you're hiring me, let's say I was not just Mike Hanahan Architecture, let's say I'm Helmut Jahn, or I'm somebody that has Starkitect qualities or something, where you are hiring for that individual. If there's something special about that individual can't assign it to someone else and say, I'm going to have somebody else do my work for me. No, I hired you, though there may be an element of why you selected that individual, those personal services. And sometimes that even comes down to like you can't hire Scarlett Johansson to be in your movie and then Scarlett signs a contract and says, you know, I'm going to assign it to, some other actress. They're going to say, no, you can't delegate or assign your duties. We hired Scarlett Johansson. So those are types of personal things. They cannot be assigned or delegated. General generic duties can be assigned and delegated. I'm doing architectural services. I'm just Joe Architect there and maybe. And even then, it's questionable, but certainly like lawn cutting services or something that really is generic, you can assign and delegate those things if you need. Okay? Okay. How do we interpret a contract? Did I get too far? Hold on. Yeah, interpretation of the contract. So, goal. What's the goal of contracts? Again, predict future predictability. And so you want to be able to figure out when you're interpreting, when you're looking at the contract, this is kind of someone later down the line. Is there a mistake of fact? Is there problems between the other? Someone needs to interpret it. What does it really mean? Because if we're in a dispute, if we're at arbitration, if we're at court and trial, Obviously, both sides have a different interpretation of what the contract means. That's why we're there. You told me you were going to do this, you didn't. You told me you were going to provide this money, you failed to. Well, I didn't think you owed it, or I didn't owe you, or whatever it might be. So the parties are at odds. Somebody has to step in the middle and interpret. How do they do that? The trier of fact determines what the actual deal is. So in court or in arbitration, you have a trier of fact and a trier of law. The trier of law is the judge or the panel, and they're going to say, this is what the law says. But the trier of fact is going to be the jury. It could be the judge, but they're going to listen to what the facts are. And they're going to say, I heard from Sally, I heard from Billy, I heard from Tom, I heard from Joan. All these facts mean, I think the contract says this. I'm going to listen to the facts and interpret what the contract means. Also, I'm going to read it myself. The court or arbitrator, however, will not rewrite the contract. So if Sally says, the contract in my mind means A, B, and C, but the language doesn't say that, the court's not going to rewrite the language just because Sally thought it meant something different. And if Tom does the same thing, I think, well, my obligation to make payment was from these provisions, the court's not going to change that because the contract wasn't the meeting of the minds between the parties, presumably. And so that's what they're going to do there. So how do we get there? First level analysis, the objective language of the contract prevails. The written word is the most important. Clear and unambiguous language is always enforced as written. Clear and unambiguous. As we know, Harpo and Groucho can show you the contract doesn't always have clear and unambiguous language. And so for those interpretations, sometimes you have to look at the courts and the case law and the parties' facts and issues and what happened. But if it's clear and ambiguous, you must follow that. No explanations or clarifications of the language is permitted. You can't come in and say, I know it says this, but this is what it really means. This is what we really agreed. The courts do not have to listen to that. They are supposed to be enforcing it as written. And why do you do this? Why do we go through this process? Well, again, it's to resolve the conflicts. You guys sat down way back when and you had this deal, and this is the deal you were supposed to follow. Now, I took out a slide when I was going through this last night, which had the second level. It's this thing called promissory estoppel, and it's a very complex legal term. And I remember, like, I was going to start explaining it to you guys. I try to explain it every year, and I always say, I'm never going to test you on it. So I just took it out. But the concept is, just so you know, is even though there's this whole concept of clear and unambiguous language, and the courts aren't supposed to look outside of that clear and unambiguous language, there are times when you can make the argument that the language is not clear and unambiguous, or the application of the language, maybe the language is clear, but the facts upon when that language is relevant or should be applied don't apply here. Meaning, the parties are supposed to do A, B, and C if this happens. It's very clear what A, B, and C is. That's clear and unambiguous. And if they don't follow A, B, and C, somebody's in breach. But what may be ambiguous, what may be not clear, is the part where it says, if this happens. Did this happen or not? Is this relevant or not? Was this part of the timing or not? And the courts may hear facts about that to enforce the clear and ambiguous language. So that's what happens in laws, is where not every clause in the contract is exactly what it says, because there may be something more. It depends. Okay. Express and implied terms. Remember way back when I was like implied in fact and express terms? Express terms are spelled out either in writing and oral. We know exactly what they are. Implied terms are part of the agreement. They're within the agreement, but they may not be discussed and they may not be written down. The standard of care, your question earlier, if it just says the parties need to perform in accordance with the standard of care, it's implied that it's a normal architect working in that space for that type of project. It's implied that it already knows. If the project has the contract and it has the drawings attached, it's implied that the contractor knows custom and practice. Remember number 7 in our hierarchy, the industry custom and practice. It's implied that the contractor knows how to build this space because they saw the drawings, they read the contract, and they provided a bid. So implied terms exist in a contract, but they are never written down, because everybody knows, or should know, that that architect is going to conform to the standard of care, and the contractor knows how to build this type of space. Those are implied terms. Commonly implied terms in construction contracts. Neither party will hinder the other party from performing the contract. It seems pretty logical. I'm not going to stop you from doing your construction. You're going to not stop me from whatever I need to do. It could be so much as, if you don't pay me, I'm allowed to stop. It's implied. Why would I keep working for free? The contract may not say that, but should be implied, because if you don't pay me, you are hindering me from performing my work because I'm doing stuff for free. So it's implied that you're allowed to stop if you don't get paid, even if the contract doesn't say it. Construction will be performed in a good and workmanlike manner. Any good contract will have that as express language, but if it doesn't have that, would you ever think that the contractor is entering into a contract? Like, if you're the owner and you hire a contractor to build your house, you probably never would think that the contractor says, I'm promising to give you some crappy work. You're not going to do that. Even if the contract doesn't say I'm going to do good work, it's implied when you hire them that they're going to do good work. So that is an implied contract provision in all construction contracts that doesn't have to be writing. The architect will perform his duties in accordance with the appropriate standard of care. Even if that standard of care, just the basic language, isn't in there, it's implied that they will do that because that's their professional responsibility. When I get hired as a lawyer, it's implied that I will represent my client with the utmost zeal. That's one of my model rules that I have to follow, my ethical rules, that I am performing my duties with the utmost zeal for that client. It's not in my contract with them, my engagement letter. I've never seen the word zeal in anything I've entered into with my client, but it is in the model rules, so it's implied that I'm going to do that. All right, last few slides. I'm going to talk about what happens if there's inconsistencies in the contract. I got like 12 minutes. Told you I'd get them all in. Okay. If there's inconsistencies and contradictions with contracts, because that happens. Nobody's perfect. Sometimes you may read a provision in a contract and then you go to the drawings and you're like, oh my God, that says something opposite. What do you do? Or maybe you're looking in the drawings, like, since not a lot of you guys have worked yet, you're going to prepare, but maybe you already know this, you're going to prepare a set of plans and specifications, drawings and specifications. And then you're going to have the drawings, which will be plans and elevations and section cuts and everything else. It's going to be the graphic part of it. And then there's a specification book. And the specification book is going to talk about types of materials and how things go together, and it's all written. And spec books, like I've had projects where spec books are 1,800 pages long for some of the big factories and plants that I've worked on and everything else. Sometimes the specifications are, 10 pages. They're very small. But you may have a drawing, and you may have a set of specifications, and they may say something different. It may have a drawing of a wall section cut, and it talks about the type of materials for the wall, and then you read the wall section, you read what wall should be in the type of lumber, and it says something different. Those are inconsistencies. It happens. So what do you do? Are the words contradictory? Is there inconsistency? That's what I'm talking about. Is there an interpretation clause in the contract? Sometimes you're going to have, the contract will have a paragraph that says, in the event of inconsistencies, or it'll say interpretation of this contract, and it'll give a order. It'll be like, change orders over contract, drawings over specifications, detail over general, those types of things. So it'll give a listed order to tell the reader, whether it's the contractor or the owner, or the trier of fact, if you're at a dispute, which comes first, second, and third. You would like to have an interpretation clause. But if not, there are some judicial rules. The courts have their own rules. Detailed or specific over general. That's a court rule. Later in time versus earlier in time. If I have a contract signed in 2015 and there's a change that came in 2018, the court's going to look at 2018 first because it came later in time. Those are some general rules of how the courts deal with inconsistencies. Like I said, one document may supersede the other. It may be written. Specifications supersede drawings. That's an example of what you might see and how to resolve inconsistencies. Requiring lengthier or more expensive procedure. Sometimes it may specifically say, in the specifications. If there's a question over that, we want the more detailed or lengthier or expensive procedure to get it done because you want the best quality. Sometimes there's language about substitution. Maybe there's a type of material that you want to use or the architect has specified. The contractor can buy a substituted material, does the same thing, but it's cheaper. Like, architects suggested this type of beam. You're never going to see it. I have one that's going to perform the exact same way. I want to put it in as a substitute. I'm going to save you $50,000 on this. Do you want the architect's beam that they designed, the special design, or do you want to use my beam? You can substitute that as long as it has equal performance. As long as the owner is septic, there's going to be rules because obviously that beam is inconsistent with the drawings. And if the beam fails, there may be an interpretation of whether that substitution was proper. So that's what sometimes comes in. And then the other question is who has the duty of inquiring about the inconsistencies for that situation of whether the contractor wants to bring in a different beam or what have you? They have the obligation to raise that. There may be language in there about how to do substitutes, but if they are outside of the substitution requirement of the contract, it's up to the contractor to ask that question. Anything on that? As I said, if the contract doesn't say it, the judicial rules will have, the courts will interpret specific rather than general. Contract language will be construed against the party who drafted the contract. That almost never happens because the courts normally say the parties are equal. This middle one is kind of the David and Goliath type rule, like the big company up here has all the power and they force the small company in to sign this contract. In some but very rare instances, the court will say, I'm going to look at this provision most favorably to David because Goliath had all of the power here. So I'm going to look at it negatively or not necessarily against the Goliath, but certainly in the favored and the light of the David. So that's where the how they do an inconsistency there. They're also going to treat the contract as a whole. We're not going to take this one tiny little provision and try to figure out what it means. We're going to see how it relates to every provision in this contract. So they're going to, that's another judicial rule of how they look at it. How do they interpret the contract as a whole? They're trying to make sure the courts, if they don't have any instructions in the actual language of the contract, the courts are trying to figure out what was the deal and what was fair. So let's look at this whole situation. Okay? Can you modify a contract? Yes. And this is one of the most important things for you guys in your profession. Have any of you guys ever heard of what's called a change order? How many people know what a change order is? One, two, so a couple of them. So in a project, you guys are going to draw up your buildings and you're going to send it out, and there is never in the entire course of your entire career that you will have a perfect set of drawings. And you're not expected to be because the standard of care doesn't require perfection. There's going to be times in the project where the contractor's not going to understand what you did, and you're going to have to redraw something, and the contractor's going to go to the owner and is like, oh, that's going to cost me more money. I want more money. And a change order is written. That's a modification of the contract. Another type of change order is the owner's building a 3-bedroom, 2-bath house, and the owner's like, oh, I wanted 3 bathrooms. So it's not like the drawings were wrong. It's not like the contractor bid on something independent. The owner has said, I want another bathroom. That is a change to the contract because the contract was for 3 bedrooms, 2 baths. Now it's 3 and 3. That is a modification of the contract, a change order. Or, last example, but there's many, many more, contractor's digging a hole to put the foundation in and he gets 3 or 4 feet down and it turns out the soil below that is really crappy. It's silty soil and everything else. And so they need to bring in more trucks for compaction or something else, or equipment to compaction to make sure they can pour the foundation. Contractor's going to say, we didn't know this condition existed. It's not our fault. It's not your fault, owner, but somebody has to pay for this. This is your house. We get a change order. All of those are modifications to contracts. And so, yes, contracts may be modified. How do you do this? Parties who sign the contract, they always agree to modifying the contract. Anytime after you sign a contract, if the parties agree, they can change it. They are allowed. And this is the best one. Even a contract that says you cannot modify can be modified because you know what you're doing? You're modifying the provision that says you can't modify it. And you're allowed to do that. Because the first thing says you can always modify. So my contract says, I'm not allowed to change this contract with you, and I walk to you and say, hey, you guys want to agree to change this contract? And you say yes, then that provision doesn't mean anything anymore. So you can always modify a contract even if it says you can't modify it. And you can even modify, you can orally modify written contracts. Even if a written contract says this contract may only be modified by a written provision, you can orally change that by saying, hey, do you guys want to orally change this contract? Yeah, some of you won't say it that way, but you can come to a deal and like, hey, can you put some more dirt in our garden or throw down some more soil or change this window? And you do it orally. You're like, yeah, I can do that. It's going to cost you, you know, $50, $100, $1,000, whatever it's going to be. And later you say, I don't have to pay you. What do you mean you don't have to pay me? I did the work for you. Well, because it says in this contract that the only way I have to get a change is if it's in writing. But we orally agree. You are allowed to orally modify a contract that says you cannot orally modify a contract. Now, it's not to say you shouldn't put that provision in. You should put that provision in because it puts the cues and it says to everybody, make it in writing so you don't have to fight about it later. It's always important to write it down. But those rules are only as good as until both parties agree not to follow the rules. But they have to both agree. So, the timing of the modification is key as well. Like, when you guys decide to modify. If the guy throws the extra soil or dirt in the yard and then comes back and says, pay me for it, he already did the work. Is that really a modification? It may go back to earlier on in our discussion about whether there was a quasi-contract and whether it should be implied in law and blah, blah, blah. We're going to talk about that. But the point is you want to do the modification of the contract, oral, written, or otherwise, before the work is done. Because if you don't do it before the work is done, you may not pay for it. So that's more common. But the basics about this provision, or this slide, is you can always modify a contract. Last slide. And I got 1 minute. Reformation is the contract. Reformation's contract, I'm going to just tell you what it is. There will be no reformation questions on the exam. There are going to be some modification change orders on the exam. So remember that slide before. But you can just hear me for the next minute and you don't have to worry about any of this being on the exam. Reformation of the contract is when the written terms of the agreement do not accurately reflect the actual agreement reached between the parties. We had a meeting of the minds, but somebody wrote it down incorrectly. And so when we go to court and we both tell the trier of fact, I wanted A, B, and C. And the other side says, I wanted A, B, and C. And the contract says D, E, and F. The courts will reform the contract to say, even though it says D, E, and F, it should be A, B, and C. Because they both told us there was a meeting of the mind. It will accurately reflect the agreement between the parties. You still have to have a lawsuit for reformation. So you can actually get the testimony to say A, B, and C, A, B, and C. Sometimes one party may say, well, it's really A, B, and D, and the other one says A, B, and C, when you're trying to figure it out, and maybe it takes the court to reform and say, no, what you really guys had was A, B, and C. You both were on the same page. And after hearing all the facts, I'm going to reform the contract to that. That's sometimes what happens. You need a court to do that. And the party seeking the reformation information through this in reformation should have a good reason. They got to say, well, there was a mutual mistake of fact, maybe there was fraud. Some of these things of why you want to get to what the terms are. You have to have these requirements or these reasons. Like I said, it's much more in depth than law about reformation. In my 30-some years of being a lawyer, I've never reformed a contract. In my 30-some years of being a lawyer, I've only had one rescission. So these two R's, the reformation rescissions, rarely come up. That's why you're not going to be tested on it. But just to give you a big picture of that. 12:15. I told you I could do it. So next week, let me see what we got next week.